On behalf of the New York State Cessation Center Collaborative, I would like to turn the call over now to Ms. Annie Beigel.
Thank you, Elizabeth, and a good afternoon to everyone. I'm Annie Beigel, Manager of Cessation Programs for the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, the New York State Smokers Quitline, I'd like to welcome you to today's conference call, Tobacco Dependence and Chronic Disease, with our featured speaker, Dr. David McFadden, Instructor of Medicine at the College of Medicine, Mayo Clinic. In listening to Dr. McFadden's presentation today, you will notice how pervasive tobacco use is in chronic disease. And as our healthcare systems move forward to electronic health records, tobacco dependence treatment protocols may be something that that you can use to ensure that is captured in your EHRs. As a matter of fact, the American Academy of Family Physicians has put out recommended fields for tobacco dependence treatment, and their recommendations are simple and easy to include in an EHR. So if your office is looking to purchase an EHR or you're upgrading, you may want to consider using the recommended fields of the American Academy of Family Physicians. And we're pleased to offer continuing education hours, including CME, CEU, OASIS clock hours, and CRCE credits. To fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Dr. McFadden conducted tobacco treatment seminars at Pfizer-sponsored conferences in Brazil, Chile, and Mexico. He did not receive any honorarium from Pfizer or Mayo Clinic. Pfizer reimbursed the Mayo Clinic for these services. Now, to obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms, which are posted on the website. And please remember, all applications for credit will not be accepted after November 12th. Now, that's a week from this Friday, so please be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible so you can receive your credit. And so now it's my pleasure to hand the call over to Dr. David McFadden. Dr. McFadden?
Good morning, and greetings from Rochester, Minnesota, the other Rochester. It's a real privilege today to present this topic to you, that tobacco dependence is a chronic disease. Those of you who have been involved in smoking cessation programs, I'm sure, are probably familiar with many of these concepts, but hopefully we can give you some more information that will be of value to you. I believe, if you look at the first slide, it just gives my name. On the next slide, you've already heard about my disclosures. Let's move on to the objectives of our conference today. This is the third slide in your handout. First of all, we're going to discuss the prevalence of tobacco use, looking at particular changes in prevalence over the last 5 to 10 years, and looking at some statewide prevalences comparing different areas of the country. We're going to talk about the rationale of treating tobacco dependence as a chronic disease and why we consider it a chronic disease. And then we're going to look at some of the specific tobacco-related morbidity and mortality with specific tobacco-related diseases. And finally, we're going to end up our discussion with the U.S. Public Health Service's clinical practice guidelines that came out in 2008. We're going to review those briefly. And at the end of the session, we will have some time for question Q&A. So if you have questions as we go along, please jot them down. We'll try to answer them at the end of the session. Let's move on to the next slide. We all know that smoking is bad, but just how bad is it really? If you look at the next slide, the cigarette death epidemic in perspective in the United States, you compare it with all the deaths that have occurred from other causes, such as the number of deaths in World War II, automobile accidents, Vietnam War, annual murders, heroin, morphine, cocaine deaths. We add all of those up, and you can see they still do not surpass the annual tobacco-related mortality in this country, which exceeds 400,000 people per year. That's the equivalent of about 1,000 people per day, or if you see in your slide there, the equivalent of 3 747 airliners crashing every day. But we don't hear much about that in the news as related to tobacco mortality. In the next slide, We notice that tobacco is the only consumer product that's proven to kill more than half of its regular users. And this is some data that was presented by Richard Pito, one of the famous epidemiologists in the UK. It's estimated in the United States every year that about 443,000 people die from tobacco use. Worldwide, that number is about 5 million deaths every year. And if you look at the worldwide picture of tobacco use, what we're noticing is that there's going to be an increasing mortality burden in the developing world, such countries as China and India. And you look on the next slide. If we look at worldwide tobacco-related mortality, the trends, though it may be 5 million per year now, by the year 2050, if the current trend in tobacco use continues worldwide, it will be up to 520 million cumulative deaths over a period of 20th and 21st century. Now, if you look at the next slide, however, we can be take a little more optimistic viewpoint if there is a change in the prevalence of tobacco use. If smoking uptake is cut in half by 2020, there will be a significant decrease, but especially if we can do something about the adult smoking rate, the current adult smoking rate, and we can somehow cut that in half by 2020, that would significantly reduce the cumulative mortality of tobacco use by 2050. And you can see the figures there on your slide. These are some estimates, once again, by Richard Pito, the UK epidemiologist. Let's go on to the next slide. It's estimated that by 2025, if current trends continue, we'll have 10 million people in the world that will die from tobacco use every year. As I pointed out before, this is increasing in the developing world as the tobacco companies are facing more and more opposition and tobacco control legislation in developed countries. They're moving their products overseas, and the developing world is facing a real epidemic. Next slide, the worldwide toll of cigarettes. 80% of the deaths eventually will occur in places like China and India. Those of you who are familiar with the tobacco epidemic in China, they have 300 million male smokers. The largest worldwide population of smokers, 2 out of 3 Chinese men smoke. India, about 110 million smokers. The United States has the distinction of having the largest female population of smokers in the world. Even though in China, two-thirds of the male population are smokers, less than 5% of the female population smoke. So those are just some background information about prevalence of tobacco use. Now let's come back home and look at some of the U.S. data. And this is data that is readily available to all of you, printed and published by the CDC. It came out the latest data from 2009. The prevalence of smoking in this country is about 20.6% if we look at the population over the age of 18, 23.5% of males, 17.9% of females. But you'll look at this and notice that there are certain population groups that are at high risk for being tobacco dependent. Most of you are familiar that those who have less education and those who are lower income have a higher prevalence of tobacco use. Those below the federal poverty level, about 31% are smokers. Those who don't have a high school diploma, about 28.5%. So there are pockets in our population that are at higher, more vulnerable for tobacco use. Let's go on to the next slide. We look at the prevalence by age, and you can see from this slide that it's tobacco use is more prevalent in younger and middle-aged population. Over the age of 65, its use does decline. Now, it's kind of interesting if we look at regional differences in the United States, and you'll notice that the best is in the West with only 16% prevalence. The Midwest is about 23%. If we look state by state, the highest tobacco use is in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Oklahoma. Lowest tobacco prevalence is in Utah, California, and Massachusetts. Now, New York comes in below the national average at 18.1%. I was just reading some statistics recently. I know that you've had a major effort at tobacco control in New York City, I understand, as a result of your efforts that have been very successful. The tobacco prevalence in New York City, I understand, has decreased from about 21 to 17% as of 2006. Now, I don't have the latest statistics for that. It may have well decreased even further. But there are some excellent tobacco control efforts ongoing in New York. Now, the next slide just shows you a map, kind of give you an overall idea of the prevalence of tobacco use around the country. You notice that the black states are those that have the highest prevalence. The white states, are obviously Utah and California, have the lowest prevalence. And you can kind of get an idea of that the heaviest tobacco use is in the Midwest and South, where the lowest is in the western states. If we look at ethnic groups on the next slide, there are certain ethnic groups that definitely have a significant lower use of tobacco, and that includes the Asian American population, 12%. As I mentioned, the female smoking rate in China is very low due to cultural norms. Interestingly enough, Hispanic population prevalence about 14.5%. And we go on down to multiracial, and American Indians have a higher prevalence, multiracial groups almost up to 30%. So this just gives you a background, some background information on the prevalence of tobacco use. Let's go on to the next slide, look at some of the trends. In California, the prevalence has declined. The prevalence of lung cancer has declined about 40% over an eight-year period from 1998 to 2006. It's about four times faster than the rest of the country. Maine, New York, and Washington have had significant reduction in youth smoking as a result of excellent comprehensive statewide smoking tobacco control programs. The next slide is kind of an interesting one, and this is a study that just came out recently, published in the Nicotine and Tobacco Research Journal. It came out in July of this year, and it looked at tobacco use among health professionals. As you may be aware, the highest prevalence among health professionals is among the registered nurses population of about 13%. Primary care physicians, there was only about 2% or less than 2% of physicians who were smokers. Now, if you look at specific physician specialties, it seems to be a little higher, emergency physicians and psychiatry. Dentists have about a 5 to 6% prevalence, dental hygienists about 5%. So those are some interesting correlations. Now, that has changed dramatically over the last 50 years, as you're all aware. Let's go on now and move on from talking about prevalence of tobacco use to tobacco addiction as a chronic disease and tobacco-related morbidity. The next slide, we talk about cigarettes. Tobacco smoke, as you may be aware, is a complex mixture of 4,000 different chemicals, 60 of which cause cancer. As we talked about the prevalence of deaths, what has been noted over the last 50 years is a significant decline in the adult smoking rate in the United States, down from 41 to about 20%. And there's been some, fortunately, there's been some decrease in youth smoking as well. The problem is that even though we have made significant strides, by the year 2005, we had the lowest consumption of cigarette in the United States for over 50 years. But since over the last 5 years, there's been very, very little further decline in tobacco use in this country. And that has been a major challenge and a major area of study and research among tobacco control scientists. Go on to the next slide, and this is where we introduce the concept of tobacco as a chronic disease. This is not a new concept, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with it. It actually was proposed by the U.S. Public Health Services guidelines back in 2000. But the reason we should consider it, when we come to treatment and management of tobacco dependence, we should consider it a chronic disease similar to diabetes and hypertension, because most smokers go through a process of quitting. Those of you who are familiar with the Prochaska stages of change will recognize that they go through periods of contemplation, pre-contemplation. They have frequent lapses and relapses, and you look at the next slide that talks about stages of change. The pre-contemplation phase, when they have no serious consideration of quitting, all of you have no doubt encountered smokers in your practice or in other settings who just have no interest in quitting at the current time. Now, if they're contemplating it, planning to quit sometime in the near future, we say that's a contemplation phase. Preparation phase, they've set a quit date. Action phase, they've recently quit. Maintenance phase, they've quit for over 6 months. It's important to sometimes identify and stratify the smoker as to what stage they're at, because we would have different ways of counseling them depending on the stage. And our goal would be to motivate them to move from one stage to another, often through what we call motivational interviewing. Going on next to the rationale of chronic disease, clinicians, we should address this problem with every smoker, as with every patient visit, along with their other medical problems. It should be on their medical problem list. And I know that many of you have probably, if you've implemented an electronic medical record, you already have this as part of their permanent record. We should educate our patients to understand that smoking cessation is a process, and it occurs often over months or years. We need to help them understand, even when they quit, that the risk of relapse is lifelong. And at times I try to use the analogy of Alcoholics Anonymous, where we, those who attend AA meetings, always identify themselves as an alcoholic, that they're vulnerable to relapse. Going on to the next slide, cigarettes and tobacco dependence. As I mentioned, cigarette smoke contains 4,000 chemicals. The tobacco companies have done a marvelous job of developing, of manufacturing cigarettes that are a very efficient device for nicotine delivery, and its nicotine is the chemical that causes the dependence. In fact, as you may be well aware, nicotine delivery through the cigarette is a very rapid process. Nicotine is delivered to the brain within 7 seconds of an inhalation of cigarette smoke, much faster than intravenous preparations. Cigarette manufacturers have also altered the tobacco, the pH, because they discovered that an alkaline pH to the tobacco increases the absorption of tobacco and nicotine through the mucous membranes of the mouth and the oral cavity. We know that as a smoker continues to smoke, that the nicotine results in increased upregulation of the nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, both in the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. We also have become aware more recently that there are genetic factors that influence tobacco dependence. In fact, there are some ethnic populations that are a slower metabolite. They metabolize nicotine at a slower rate. This is particularly true in the Oriental Asian population, and it may be one reason that the volume of cigarettes and smoked among the Asian population in general is less than among the Caucasian population. We do know, as I mentioned, that up to half of smokers eventually die from a tobacco-related disease. In the United States, as next slide, deaths attributable to cigarette smoking is 438,000 deaths. These are primarily from cardiovascular disease, lung disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and cancers, especially lung cancer. On the next slide, we're going to go on then and talk more specifically about some of these tobacco-related diseases. Coronary heart disease, as you know, is the leading cause of death in the United States. However, there's been a significant decline in the incidence, because, and a lot of that's due to decreased smoking rates. The smoker has about anywhere from 2 to 6 times the risk of sudden death due to a coronary event, and we won't go into the incidence of coronary procedures because that changes year by year. Let's go on to the next slide and look at some of the physiologic effects and the reasons that smoking results in cardiovascular disease. We know that cigarette smoke increases the coagulability of the blood. It increases myocardial workload through the inhalation of carbon monoxide. This causes a relative hypoxemia and lack of oxygen and oxygenation of the myocardial tissue. We also know that cigarette smoke increases catecholamine release, which results in vasoconstriction. We know that cigarette smoking has an impact on the lipid metabolism, and cigarette smokers tend to have lower HDL levels, higher total cholesterol levels. It affects the endothelial function function of the arterial walls, causes oxidant injury. We mentioned increased thrombosis, blood viscosity is increased. Another thing that you may not be aware of, those of you who frequently see smokers and as part of their routine physical exam, they get a complete blood count. Smokers tend to have mild relative leukocytosis or an elevated white count. Going on to the next slide, cardiovascular disease related to smoking is not only in the coronary arteries, but affects the vascular beds throughout the body, including cerebrovascular, coronary circulation, as well as aortic function and peripheral vascular beds, including lower extremity peripheral vascular disease. Abdominal aortic aneurysms prevalence is increased in smokers. In fact, approximately 3 to 4 years ago, the U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force recommended that any male smoker over the age of 65, smoker or ex-smoker, should be screened for abdominal aortic aneurysm at least once. That's male smokers over the age of 65, either smoker or ex-smoker, they should have an imaging screening test, usually an abdominal ultrasound, to screen for abdominal aortic aneurysms. Next slide, we note that sudden cardiac death is much more common in smokers. In one study, they looked at they followed smokers for over 8 years, compared current smokers, the risk of sudden cardiac death was significantly increased, almost 2.5 times that of the ex-smoker or non-smoker. The next slide is one that I think is very interesting to point out to those who claim that they are light smokers and they're not concerned because they smoke only a few cigarettes a day. This was a large multi-country study looking at the prevalence of the odds of having a myocardial infarction related to the number of cigarettes smoked per day. You can see here that the odds ratio even for 1 to 5 cigarettes per day is significantly increased over those of a non-smoker of having had a myocardial infarction. And then obviously there's a dose response, so that the more that they smoked, the more likelihood they were of having had a myocardial infarction. But it points out, the important point is that even light smokers have an increased risk of cardiovascular disease and myocardial infarction. What I often try to point out to patients and tobacco users, however, is that it's not only we try to combine positive news and good news with bad news. And on the next slide, we see the risk of heart attack smokers versus ex-smokers. And you can see that after a number of years of quitting, the risk of cardiac disease of the ex-smoker decreases almost to that of the non-smoker. Now, there are varying statistics on how long that takes, anywhere from 3 to 5 years, but it appears that the risk of cardiovascular disease decreases more rapidly than their risk of cancer, and we'll talk about that a little later. In the next slide, this is just a slide to show the leading causes of death in the United States, how that's varied over the last, from 1970 to 2002. Heart disease has definitely decreased. You'll notice, however, that chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, has actually been on the increase. Next, we are going to talk about respiratory diseases related to cigarette smoking. You're all familiar with this. The next slide here, COPD, reduced lung function, cough. There's increased cough, wheezing, shortness of breath in smokers. They have difficulty controlling their asthma. You can see here a picture of a lung with emphysema and a normal lung. The emphysematous lung also has a focus of cancer. COPD, on the next slide, you're familiar. As I mentioned, it's increasing in prevalence in the United States. 80% of COPD deaths are related to smoking. We talk about three types of COPD, chronic bronchitis, emphysema, and asthma. They're all related to decreased oxygenation of the body and decreased airflow, shortness of breath. Asthma, on the next page, smoking is related to increased severity of asthma and poor asthma control. There's some debate about whether smoking actually is a cause of asthma, but that's probably not important, except to the fact that we note that any patient who has asthma and continues smoking, they develop more severe shortness of breath and they have more difficulty controlling their asthma, and thus should be counseled regularly to quit. Next slide shows those of you who are respiratory therapists will be familiar with spirometry, FEV1, forced expiratory volume in 1 second. This is an important slide that I like to illustrate and remind patients that there is no age in which it's too late to quit smoking. We know that lung function declines with age, and you can see with the top curve there that even the non-smoker has a decline in FEV1 as they age. But the earlier they stop smoking, the less the decline in their FEV1 will be. Even if they stop at age 65, their decline in FEV1 will be less than that of the smoker who continues to smoke even in their older age. So this is an important concept to keep in mind. The next slide, a couple slides I'm going to go through quickly. Smoking and TB, there is some relationship primarily in countries where TB is more prevalent, such as India and Asia. Smoking and pulmonary TB, it's a risk factor. This is the next slide, development of pulmonary TB compared to non-smokers, about 2.24 times the risk. Going on to the next slide, we're going to go on now and talk about tobacco smoke related to cancer or carcinogenesis, its role in carcinogenesis. Next slide, carcinogenicity of tobacco smoke. As I mentioned, it contains 60 chemicals which can cause cancer, 4,000 chemicals in tobacco smoke, but 60 of them are capable of causing cancer. On the next slide is a list of about 10 of these, including arsenic, benzene, lead, nitrosamines. There's a whole host of chemicals within the tobacco smoke that is related to, that can be causative of cancer. Looking on the next slide, medical complications of tobacco. Cigarette smoking is responsible for about 30% of all cancer deaths, and the risk of cancer is about twice as high in the smokers, four times as high in heavy smokers. It's linked to multiple different types of cancers. If you look on the next slide, we're going to look specifically at smoking and lung cancer. Next slide, lung cancer remains the leading cause of cancer death in both men and women in this country. About 15% of smokers will develop lung cancer. In 2008, there was about 215,000 new cases and 161,000 deaths. It causes all types of lung cancers, all four major cell types, 90% of lung cancers. Some smokers, when they quit, they switch to cigar and pipe smoking. Even cigar and pipe smoking is associated with increased risk of lung cancer, although we don't have as nearly as much data. Unfortunately, the survival of lung cancer is dismal. It obviously varies with the race and gender. But there is a reduced risk with stopping smoking. Next slide, next two slides just show the prevalence of lung cancer in men and women. It peaked in men in about 1980. It's now on the decline in men because of the decline in smoking. There's a lag period of about 20 to 30 years after smoking initiation and the risk of developing lung cancer. The next slide shows that in women, lung cancer is now the leading cause of cancer death, and it surpassed breast cancer in the mid-1980s in women. Next slide, you're all familiar, most of you know who Peter Jennings is. Unfortunately, his life was cut short. He was a lifelong smoker. He had a history of lung cancer. The risk, next slide, the risk of lung cancer depends on the smoking habit. Obviously, current smoking, they have a much higher risk of about eight times higher than that of the non-smoker. But the next slide shows that this is related to the volume of smoking, the amount of cigarettes smoked per day, and how many years they've smoked. We usually relate this in pack years, multiplying the number of packs per day by the number of years they've smoked. Those who've smoked 60 pack years, that's two packs a day for 30 years, they have nearly 20 times the risk of developing lung cancer compared to the non-smoker. There is a multiple medical literature that has confirmed these findings, and this was first noted in the U.S. Surgeon General's report in 1964. Next slide is something that you may not be aware of. COPD itself is a risk factor for lung cancer, and this shows that those with moderate to severe COPD have an increased likelihood of developing lung cancer compared to those who have a normal lung function, the orange dotted line at the bottom of the graph. So COPD itself is a risk factor for lung cancer. Next slide. In summary, smoking and lung cancer, the risk of lung cancer obviously increases with the quantity and the length of smoking, the duration of smoking, COPD, severity of lung function, and we don't have time to go into it today, but environmental tobacco or secondhand smoke exposure is also a risk factor for lung cancer. In fact, approximately 50,000 deaths every year in the United States is estimated to be due to environmental tobacco smoke. Those include both cancer deaths as well as cardiovascular mortality. What we do know is that the risk of lung cancer and lung cancer death decreases with the duration of abstinence and the age at cessation. The next slide shows this very clearly, that the number of years since quitting smoking, although it's not as rapid as the reduced risk in cardiovascular disease, by 10 to 15 years, the ex-smoker is almost down to that. The risk is almost down to that of a non-smoker. And the next slide shows, this is a slide that I use often to explain that quitting smoking at any age can have benefit. Even the person who quits at the age of 60, the black dotted line, the black hyphen line just below the purple line that's continuing cigarette smokers, you can see that they will have a reduced cumulative risk of lung cancer no matter what age they quit smoking. Next slide is just another slide to illustrate the benefits of quitting, and we'll move on. Smoking cessation, lung cancer risk reduction, looking at current smokers, recent ex-smokers, distant ex-smokers, and once again, those who have quit smoking for more than 5 years, their risk of lung cancer decreases significantly. Now let's go on in the last few minutes of our discussion here, talking about some of the other health effects of tobacco use. As you're aware, it can cause periodontal disease, dental disease, adverse surgical outcomes. We highly recommend people who are contemplating surgery to quit smoking for at least a week or a couple weeks before. Cataracts have been associated with smoking, low bone density and hip fractures, peptic ulcer disease. The next slide just gives a list of some of the complications during pregnancy of cigarette use. And go on to the next slide. Smoking and macular degeneration is another association that has been noted. Smokers have an increased risk of age-related macular degeneration, about 1.5 times the risk of a non-smoker. On the next slide, the skin effects of smoking is a problem that has been noted for some time, but not always familiar to smokers. And they've done studies published in the International Journal of Dermatology. The severe wrinkling increases with a number of pack years of smoking. If you want to know some of the mechanisms, the next slide, skin effects of smoking, free radical production. This is some of the pathophysiology suspected as a cause of tobacco-related skin wrinkling. If you look at the next slide, this is a picture of a lady who's a smoker, and then the following slide is her 52-year-old twin who's a non-smoker, and I don't know how clear that copies in your handout, but there you can see there's a significant difference between the two ladies, even though they're twins. And going on now, finally, we're going to finish off here with the U.S. Public Health Service's clinical practice guidelines, just reviewing some of the concepts. Now, this particular body and recommendations are made based on the review of a very astute committee of thousands of research articles on smoking and tobacco control and research and smoking cessation methodology, research of articles that were published within the last 10 years. Most of you are familiar with the fact that JACO requires intervention for smokers who are hospitalized with myocardial infarction, pneumonia, and congestive heart failure. Here at Mayo Clinic, we do have a smoking counselors that meet with patients who are hospitalized and have a history of tobacco use and offer them smoking cessation treatment. You're all familiar, and I won't say much about telephone quit lines, but they've been very, very helpful. We do have medications now that are available. We'll talk about that in a minute. In the next slide, tobacco dependence is a chronic disease. We talked about that. It needs to be set up as that. We need to identify every smoker who comes to our office, and every patient willing to make a quit attempt should be offered both counseling and medication. One of the major emphasis of the guidelines is that the dual model of therapy of counseling, such as motivational interviewing, as well as pharmacotherapy, offers the best opportunity for the smoker to quit. Even brief tobacco dependence treatment is effective, and every patient should be offered at least brief treatment. Next slide, as I mentioned, combination of counseling and medication is more effective than either alone. Telephone quit line counseling is effective. Motivational interviewing is effective. Tobacco dependence treatments are effective and highly cost-effective, and insurers and health plans are becoming more willing to pay both for counseling and medications. The next slide. In the 2008 guidelines, there is stronger evidence now that counseling is an effective tobacco use treatment strategy. It adds significant to the approved medications. This can be done on the telephone or face-to-face, but we do know that counseling is an extremely important component of tobacco cessation programs. The next slide, you're all familiar with the 5 A's, where we ask, advise, assess, assist, and arrange. This should be a vital sign. Every physician should have responsibility for doing this. Very interesting, in the same article I mentioned to you that talked about the prevalence of tobacco use in health professionals, looked at how we are doing as physicians with the 5 A's. Most of us do ask our patients whether they smoke or not, about 90% up to 99%. Most of us advise, 65% to 95% of us advise our smokers to quit. Not all of us assess where they are at in their quitting process. We drop off a little bit when we try to assist them in quitting, and especially when we try to arrange for follow-up. Treatment, only about 23% of us really go that far with our smokers. The 5 R's you're familiar with, we need to make the advice we give relevant to them, discussing their smoking related to their particular disease, and outline the risks of continuing and rewards of quitting. Reinforce the motivational message at each visit, even though they may be in the pre-contemplation phase. If we keep reminding them of our concern in a very sympathetic and empathetic approach, they will often respond. Going on to the next slide, motivational interviewing. As I mentioned, we should express empathy, roll with resistance, support self-efficacy. We don't have time to discuss this in detail, but those of you who are psychologists, addiction specialists, are probably very familiar with the concepts of motivational interviewing, which have been found to be very successful, relatively successful in tobacco control programs. The next slide just gives you a list of the medications that are now available. Pharmacotherapy, we have 5 types of NRT, bupropion and varenicline, and we here at Mayo Clinic, and I'm sure you as well, we often combine our medications using NRT with bupropion or NRT even with varenicline. We will often combine several different types of NRT, and we find that this is most helpful. We do know that using pharmacotherapy doubles the quit rate of the ultimate one-year quit rate. So it is important to offer the patients pharmacotherapy. Second-line therapy we rarely use for smoking cessation. Next slide. All smokers trying to quit should be encouraged to use pharmacotherapies. The only caveat to that is pregnant smokers, we do use pharmacotherapy, but only after intensive psychological behavioral modification efforts. Light smokers, there's less data, but even light smokers may benefit. go on to the next slide. Every office should have a tobacco user identification system. Education and resources should be available. The staff should be dedicated to provide tobacco dependence advice. Hospital policies should support and provide inpatient treatment. I'll go on to the next slide. I just wanted to mention briefly in finishing here that at Mayo Clinic we do have a nicotine dependence center that was established in 1988. It's an integrated approach of using behavioral model addiction pharmacotherapy. We have outpatient counseling by tobacco treatment specialists, inpatient counseling also by tobacco treatment specialists and nurse practitioners. We also have a residential treatment program where tobacco users can come and spend a week in an inpatient setting. It's a very intensive program, multi-component. They're in a tobacco-free milieu. This is the next slide. Daily, we make rounds on these patients, make changes in their pharmacotherapy. And the next slide shows the results, the quit rates in our nicotine dependence center. Individual outpatient counseling, one-year quit rates, about 25%. Individual bedside counseling in the hospital, about 32%. Our residential treatment program has about a 50% one-year quit rate. So that seems to be the most effective. But these are highly addicted smokers who have failed multiple attempts in the past to quit. In summary, tobacco-related diseases, as we all know, are the most important preventable cause of death around the world. And we should always consider tobacco dependence as a chronic disease because of the chronicity of relapses, lapses, and the importance of continued observation and encouragement. Most smokers currently in the United States at least want to quit, and we need to offer them both counseling techniques and medications to support them and give them the greatest opportunity of quitting. And finally, the next slide, tobacco dependence is a disease, and we need to realize it's not a bad person with a bad habit, but a good person with a difficult disease. Approach it that way, I think we can be more successful, more supportive. At this time, I will turn it back to Patricia Bax for some information that will be important to you.
Thank you, Dr. McFadden, for your excellent presentation, and thanks to all our participants on our call today. With the Great American Smokeout right around the corner on Thursday, November 18th, and with many smokers that are planning to quit for the new year, I just want to remind everyone about our extensive Quitline resources. As you may have noticed when you went to look for the slides for Dr. McFadden's presentation today, the Quit site has experienced a facelift at nysmokefree.com. Please be sure to familiarize yourself with our valuable resources, our Click to Quit online smoke-free community, and our downloadable fact sheets and posters. And to assist you with additional resources that complement Dr. McFadden's informative presentation today, we have included our specific chronic disease downloadable fact sheets that you can download and you can feel free to copy and distribute to your patients. They're posted underneath the PowerPoint and handouts for today's presentation as supporting resources. If you have any questions or you'd like additional information on our services, please call us at 1-866-NY-QUITS. That's 1-866-697-8487. And we are here to help your patients be successful in their quit attempts. So we look forward to hearing from you and helping your patients. At this time, I'd like to turn it back to Elizabeth, who will conduct our Q&A session.
If you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, first in queue, we have Donis. Donis, your line is open. Donis, your line is open.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, good afternoon. My question is, given the controversy surrounding varenicline, are you still prescribing varenicline for your patients?
That's a very good question, and yes, we are still prescribing varenicline for our patients, but all of our counselors who deal with these patients advise them to be observant for any psychological changes or increased symptoms of depression and to notify us immediately. We prescribe it both in the outpatient and in the residential treatment program, as well as in some of our hospitalized patients. So, yes, we are continuing to prescribe varenicline. We feel it's one of the most effective medications we have for smoking cessation.
And that's exactly what I do as well, because I tell them, you know yourself best. if something does not feel the same to you, if you feel differently, then it's time for you to talk to your primary doctor and also talk to whoever is prescribing the medication for you. Other providers also prescribe it besides primary care providers.
Right.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Next in queue, we have Kristen Luke Hausman. Kristen, your line is open.
Hi. Dr. Aubrey here from Syracuse. Kristen lets me speak for her sometimes. So two questions. One is the Academy of Family Practice comment about the fact that they have some standards that could be applied to electronic medical records. It would be useful if we had a little further advice as to how to get to getting a copy of those standards. And then second, if I could, postpartum, we were working on a program to do with obstetrical intervention and really very enthusiastic about the possibility of getting ultra-aggressive, ultra-supportive, I guess, in the postpartum period, especially those women who are breastfeeding. So the question is, since medications are a bit, pharmacotherapy during pregnancy is a bit of a more of a problem, postpartum, however, it seems to be a more of an opportunity. And is there some specific advice or resource that I could go to find what's recommended for the use of pharmacotherapy postpartum, especially in breastfeeding mothers?
That's a very good question, and there are some there's some information on the website, the American College of Gynecology Obstetrics, that I think you could access. But it's very interesting. There was a recent study that looked at postpartum women who were breastfeeding, and in general, those who were had a history of tobacco use, they were less likely to use tobacco if they elected to breastfeed. So number one, encouraging breastfeeding is an important aspect of that. Now, as far as using pharmacotherapy in pregnancy or in the postpartum period, I should say during pregnancy, first of all, we do use it, but we use usually NRT in the form of nicotine gum. Bupropion and varenicline are FDA Class C, so they're not absolutely contraindicated, but unfortunately, we don't have a lot of data because there's not been a lot of studies looking at pharmacotherapy for smoking cessation in pregnancy. So we still encourage the initial approach being that of behavioral counseling, but we are OB doctors and our nicotine dependence counselors, we do prescribe such medications both during pregnancy and postpartum. So hopefully that will give you some information. I think it is an important area, and, you know, there, among pregnant women who are addicted to nicotine, it's a huge problem for them to try to quit. Many of them will quit during the pregnancy period, but then the relapse rate is very high postpartum because most of them have quit only for their fetus and not for themselves.
Thank you.
And let me jump in here and let you know where you can get a copy of the American Academy's recommended EHR fields. What I can do is we'll post, it's a one-pager, it's very simple. We can post it right here on the website. We can get that up there in a couple of days under resources. So just come back to the website page for this conference call, and we'll have it posted under resources.
Thank you. Kristen, thank you, too.
Hey.
All right. Next in queue is Sue Cridland. Sue, your line is open.
Okay, thank you. One question about the residential program that had the 50-plus percent success rate.
Yes.
Was there any insurance reimbursement for that?
Yes. We do get even some Medicare patients, we get some reimbursement. Not all insurances cover it, but we have patients that are, you know, Medicare patients. We have the whole gamut. Many of our patients that go through the program are highly addicted. Some of them have end-stage COPD and are oxygen dependent. Some of them have, have coronary. Obviously, many of them have cardiovascular disease. Some of them have cancer, but it has been a fairly effective program, very intensive. We follow up with them after they leave on a regular basis, and it's worked out well. Now, there are some that the insurance doesn't cover, and that becomes a hurdle. But more and more, we're finding that insurance companies are willing to cover such programs.
Thank you. Could someone also comment? I've read some recent research on Alzheimer's and the incidence being greater with smokers. I'm not sure how big the study group was, but that definitely seems to make an impression on people.
This is true. There are some studies, some recent data that have looked at the association between smoking and Alzheimer's disease. The data is somewhat limited, so we're hesitant to say with certainty that there it's a cause of Alzheimer's, but there does appear to be a relationship, and I think we'll have to stay tuned for that.
Thank you.
Okay. Next in queue, we have Mark Mandick. Mark, your line is open.
Thank you. I provide smoking cessation programming at a community treatment center for persons with mental health disabilities, and as you well know, it's a difficult population.
That it is.
So I guess I'm just kind of looking at or asking for any advice you might have. I find that I'm being told by most of my clients that I don't have anything else. I'm quoting, I don't have anything else but my smoking. They have no social gratification, et cetera. So they're telling me in no uncertain terms that the only thing that really gives them pleasure is smoking. So that's kind of what I'm up against.
That is a difficult position, and I'm glad you brought this point up, because among the mental health disability patients, smoking prevalence is much, much higher, anywhere from 40 to 80%. About 80% of schizophrenic patients are tobacco-dependent, nicotine-dependent, so it's a huge problem. And in fact, a lot of, up to 30 to 40% of the residual smoking population in our country have some type of mental disorder. So it's a huge problem. Now, is how you deal with these patients and how you deal with their, the argument that they make. Once again, we go back to the concept that tobacco use is a chronic disease, and we work through the stages of change. They may be in the pre-contemplation phase, but we try to use what we call motivational interviewing, and I would strongly urge you to get some reference material on motivational interviewing, because that's probably the best approach that we can use with these population groups. The other thing I want to mention is that we do not recommend tobacco treatment or smoking cessation when their psychological or mental disorder is not stable. And we've even refused to admit patients to our inpatient program if they are still alcohol dependent and unstable from that dependency. I think it's very important that their mental health condition or their other addictions be stabilized before we proceed with smoking cessation treatment.
Thank you.
Okay.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press 0, then 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, next in queue, we have Janice Hurley. Janice, your line is open.
Yes, Dr. McFadden, you mentioned something about using varenicline with nicotine replacement therapy. Could you expand on that, please?
Yeah, that's a little controversial because, as you know, the mechanism of action of varenicline is to block the nicotine acetylcholine receptor. So in theory, why would it even work? Well, we use it primarily in our residential treatment program because when patients are first admitted, when we first start on varenicline, we start on a low dose and gradually ramp it up over a week. But during that 1 week period, they're vulnerable to relapse and severe withdrawal cravings. So we use the NRT usually temporarily in patients that are on varenicline anywhere from 1 to 2 weeks. We have done a few studies, some pilot studies that show that the side effects from the combination of NRT and varenicline is not increased. So we think, in theory, it may have some benefit. We don't have a large amount of data, but we hope to have more in the future. And like I say, we do not give it usually for long periods of time in patients who are on varenicline, usually only for 1 or 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Dr. McFadden, we'll have to make that the last question.
Okay.
We're at the top of the hour. So I want to, on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers, the New York State Department of Health's Tobacco Control Program, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, we'd like to thank you sincerely, Dr. McFadden, for your very informative presentation, and thanks to all of you who are participating on today's call. Please mark your calendars. Our next conference call will be on January 5th. We'll be featuring Dr. Jonathan Fader, and he'll be covering cultural competence and tobacco dependence. So hold this date. We'll be sending out more information on this in a few weeks. And this brings us to the end of today's call. And thank you, Dr. Fadden, once again. And thank you to all of the participants, and have a good day.
It was a privilege. Thank you.